everybody to our parliamentary library lecture this month. My name is Roxanne Missingham and I'm the parliamentary librarian. We started the parliamentary library lecture series 2 years ago because we'd had a seminar series where we had people doing different positions on issues, and there were a number of issues where we needed to have a speaker who was able to give us a longer presentation about an issue that was of very high national significance or international significance. So we developed this format and it's worked very well. The lectures, if any of your colleagues are unable to attend them, are recorded. And so one of the things I'll say at the beginning is, if you've got a mobile phone, can you turn it on silent? Because the musical accompaniment is something that we'd rather do without. But they're recorded and we will make it available on the web tomorrow or the next day so that anyone who isn't able to be here or if you need to dash off, you'll be able to hear the rest of the session. We're very privileged today to be able to have Associate Professor James Lengle. He is the 2008 Fulbright American National University Distinguished Chair in American Political Science. And if you've already heard him on all of your tours, you will know what a good and interesting speaker he is. He's Associate Professor in the Department of Government at Georgetown University and the Distinguished Fellow Scholarship, which he's on, aims to build collaborative research and focus on the study of the United States in Australia. He's a noted political commentator, and when you read the words where he describes the project that he's doing this year, he seems to have an amazingly good crystal ball for the key issues of 2008, building on his knowledge of many of the elections through the 1900s. His research focuses on economic conditions, on the effects of economic conditions on the US presidential elections. He said, "Conventional wisdom amongst politicians, reporters and political analysts suggests that the state of the economy plays a major role in determining who wins the White House. When economic conditions are good or improving, the incumbent president or party in power, if the incumbent president is not seeking re-election, should benefit. If economic conditions are bad or deteriorating, then the prospects of the party out of power should improve significantly." His research looks at macroeconomic levels and microeconomic levels, and he is distinguished not just for his writing but for his professional engagement, having been president of the National Capital Area of the Political Science Association, winner of the Jack Walker Award of the Association for a journal article which is in the library called Primary Roles, Political Power and Social Change. We're very fortunate to have him speak today so close after the US elections, and I welcome you here. Thank you.
Thank you, Roxanne. It's a pleasure to be here, to be able to talk to you. I've spent the last month talking about the presidential election all over Australia, and I've enjoyed it very much, and I've enjoyed it primarily because of the level of interest I've found among Australians in the American election. It's been educational for me, and hopefully as educational for them. Let me begin the presentation with an acknowledgement, and that acknowledgement is that cephalogy, which is the scientific study of elections, is more of an art than a science, and there are very few laws in cephalogy. The only one that I'm aware of is the law of simultaneous but contrary truths. And that law states that for everyone with an opinion, there's probably someone else equally qualified saying just the opposite. So I want to preface my remarks with that law of cephalogy, just as a way to alert you that this is my interpretation based on what I watched over the last 2 or 3 months and what I've researched over the last week since the election occurred. And you may leave this room and turn on the radio or pick up the newspaper and hear someone say just the opposite. And that's just confirmation of the law of simultaneous but contrary truths. Let me start with the most obvious, and that has to do with the results. Of course, it was a good year for the Democrats. Senator Obama won 52.5% of the popular vote. Senator McCain won 46%. So the margin between Obama and McCain was approximately 6.5%. That's a significant margin, especially given how close presidential elections have been over the last 20 to 30 years. It wouldn't be considered a landslide. A landslide in American elections would normally be 55% of the popular vote or more. Senator Obama did win 365 electoral votes. Senator McCain won 162. Now, the measure for landslide in the Electoral College, Senator Obama did meet. Normally, 350 electoral votes or more is considered a landslide. You will note that Senator Obama received only 53% of the popular vote, but managed to win 365 electoral votes, which is close to 70% of the Electoral College. That's one of the effects the Electoral College has on American election outcomes. It's called the exaggerated mandate. And that's a direct result of the winner-take-all rules that are used in the United States. Whichever candidate carries a particular state, that candidate wins all of the state's electoral votes. So it's pretty normal for the winning candidate to get a greater percentage of the Electoral College vote than they received of the popular vote. The Democrats also did well in the congressional elections. Right now, they've picked up a net gain of 6 seats, and they have 57 of the 100 seats in the U.S. Senate. There are still 3 seats that are undecided. In the House, the Democrats picked up a net gain of 20 seats. That gives them right now 256 out of the 435. And there are still 3 House seats that are undecided. There were also some elections at the state and local level, and there the Democrats did equally well. They picked up a net gain of 3 governorships and now control 29 out of the 50 governorships. And they probably picked up a few more state houses along the way, although we won't know just how many for another week or so. What this, of course, means is that over the next 2 years at least, but my guess, 4 years, we will have united government in the United States, a Democratic president dealing with an overwhelmingly Democratic House and Senate. This should make it fairly easy for Senator Obama to get significant legislation through, especially during the first year. In addition, this bodes well over the near term for the Democrats. And that's because in 2010, the U.S. undergoes its annual census, and congressional districts are redistricted again in 2010. And because the Democrats will have picked up additional governorships and additional state houses, they will be in control of more state governments in 2010 than they were before the election. And of course, it's the state legislatures in the United States that redraws the district lines. So you will see many of these states, which are now dominated by the Democrats, to draw even more safely Democratic seats for the members of the House and the Senate. So that was the good news, and that's the good news, of course, only if you're a Democrat. How about if you're an American? Was there good news? Well, there was supposed to be good news. Looking at the election in advance, everyone thought that turnout would end up being historically high. You couldn't help but turn on the news, even here in Australia. I would see it, these long lines of people waiting to get into the voting booth in order to cast their ballot. And that led many to speculate that we could expect historically high turnout in the United States. Well, that didn't happen. Turnout, just using the latest results, and we're close to having them finalized, but they're not official yet. But turnout is approximately 53.8% of the voting age population. That, in fact, is lower than the turnout was in 2004. We had 123 million Americans vote in 2004. We had 124 million Americans vote this year. But of course, the size of the voting age population has increased over the last 4 years, and that means turnout was a little lower. Now, what accounts for that? Because we all saw those long lines, and we all had those expectations that turnout would be high. Well, part of that also has to do with the Electoral College. Not every state was in play. And because not every state was in play, neither of the candidates bothered to even campaign in those states or run advertisements in those states. Okay? Some states that were not in play, we normally call them safe states because they tend to be one-party states, included California and New York as Democratic states. They generally vote Democratic. They generally vote Democratic by a large margin. Texas, normally a Republican state, votes Republican by a large margin. Okay. The turnout in California, 48%. Turnout in New York, 47%. Turnout in Texas, 45%. If there isn't a campaign in these states, this doesn't generate or stimulate the interest to get people out. In addition, because of the winner-take-all principle, Democrats know they'll carry California. What's the point of turning out? Republicans know California will go Democratic. What's the point of turning out? That's one of the implications the Electoral College has for turnout in the United States. There isn't a competitive campaign in all 50 states. In fact, if you watch the election, there was a competitive campaign in a handful of states. And when you look at the turnout in those states, you do see significantly higher turnout. You're all probably aware that Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Virginia were very much up for grabs. And the candidates spent a lot of time and a lot of advertising money in those three states. Ohio had a turnout of 61%, Pennsylvania had a turnout of 61%, and Virginia had a turnout of 62%. So this sort of average overall national turnout masks significant turnout differences that exist between the states. And those turnout differences really reflect the degree to which the candidates campaigned in those states. Now, for most of us who follow elections closely, it appeared going into 2008 and through the presidential primaries and through the summer that it was going to be a good Democratic year. Bush, the current president, right now is one of the most unpopular presidents in American history. His approval rating is around 24 or 25%. And this is the second lowest approval rating in the history of public opinion polling. The lowest was registered for Harry Truman at 22%. President Bush's disapproval rating, which is in the 70s, is the highest of any president. Okay. So one of the contexts within which the election was fought out was we had a very unpopular sitting incumbent. Second, the Iraq War was and is very unpopular. A majority of Americans now believe that the Iraq War was a mistake. And third, of course, economic conditions, which were bad at the beginning of the year, quickly deteriorated even further toward the end of the year. Just to give you a sense of those conditions in the United States, I don't like to use too much data, but let me just throw out some facts which suggests that the economy didn't do very well under President Bush. GDP, that's gross domestic product, and that's a measure economists use to measure the overall standing of an economy. When GDP is going up, that means the economy is expanding. When GDP is going down, that means the economy is contracting. During President Bush's first term, the average growth in GDP per year was 2.2%. This ranked him 12th out of the last 15 presidents. His second term, average GDP growth per year was 2.2% as well. This ranked him 13th out of the last 15 administrations. Disposable personal income. During President Bush's first term, that grew at an annual rate of just 3%. President Bush's first term ranked 9th out of the last 15 administrations. President Bush's second term was even much worse when it came to growing personal income. During the second term, it grew at an annual rate of 1.9%. which ranked the second term of the Bush administration last, 15th out of 15th, over the last 15 administrations. In fact, when you look at GDP and disposable personal income, President Bush ranks as the worst two-term president over the last 50 years in his ability to grow the economy. In addition, over the summer, inflation started increasing, reached a high over the summer of 5.4%, which was the highest since 1991. The unemployment rate at the time of the national conventions was 6.1%, and it's now increased to 6.5%. And 2 million Americans were thrown out of work between July of 2007 and July of 2008. When you add the inflation rate and the unemployment rate, you get what economists call the misery index. And that was 11.5, and it's even higher now. But that 11.5 rate at the time of the national conventions was the highest in the United States since 1984. So you take these mediocre to bad economic conditions, and then you overlay the financial implosion that occurred during the last month of the election. And that explains why the polls were showing that 60 to 65% of the American electorate thought that the economy was the number one issue. And of course, Senator Obama's theme during the campaign was tying Senator McCain to the Bush administration, and as a result, because of that theme and because of economic conditions, most Americans, 55 to 60% of those who felt the economy was the most important issue, felt that Senator Obama would do a better job as president managing the economy than Senator McCain. Now, that sort of seat of the pants, looking at the general conditions and saying it looks like it's a bad year for the party in power. But academic research, which looks at these kinds of measures a little more rigorously, also suggested that Senator Obama would win and would win quite comfortably. Just using simple gross domestic product again, since I introduced it, if you go back over the last 14 administrations, there's a threshold above which the party in power generally gets reelected, and below which the party in power generally loses. And that threshold is about 3.2%. So if a president is growing GDP toward the end of year three, going into year four of his administration, the party in power is likely to win. There have been 10 instances where GDP grew at greater than 3.2% at the end of a presidential term, and the party in power won 8 out of 10 of those elections. There were 4 elections where GDP grew under 3.2%. In all 4 of those elections, the party in power lost. President Bush's GDP at the beginning of 2004 was 2.8%. That made his administration the 5th administration to fall below that 3.2 threshold and lose. Disposable personal income is also related to presidential election outcomes. If a president shows at least 2 or 3 negative quarters in the growth of disposable personal income in years 3 and 4, the party in power is likely to go down to defeat. Over the last 14 administrations, that's happened 4 times, and all 4 administrations have lost. President Bush, during his last 2 years in office, has experienced 3 quarters of negative growth. He's lost as well. That now makes 5 out of 5 administrations that have lost for failing to meet this very simple threshold. The last threshold is related to the president's approval rating. If the president's unpopular, that carries over to the party's nominee as well. And that's why Senator Obama kept hammering away at that connection as a way of tainting Senator McCain with President Bush's record. But the threshold for presidential approval ratings is 48%. If the president's approval rating is 48% or higher in year 4, normally the party in power wins. They've won 9 out of 7 instances where the approval rating's been over 48%. When it's been under 48%, the party in power has lost 5 out of 5 presidential elections. President Bush's approval rating was 23%. He is now the 6th out of 6th administrations that have failed to meet the approval threshold. Now, if all the sort of seat-of-the-pants contextual factors suggested a Democratic win, and most of the academic research suggested a Democratic win, and just one deviation here, I did want to put a plug in for my own research and model, which made use of disposable personal income and GDP to predict Senator McCain's percentage of the vote, the party in power. The model predicted that Senator McCain would win 45.6% of the popular vote, and this is based just on GDP and disposable personal income, and he won 46.1%, so the model was off by 0.5%. So the indicators all seem to suggest Obama was going to win, McCain was going to lose. But why were people hesitant to say it? And why, even towards the end of the campaign, as the polls showed the margin to be quite large, why did you see this reticence on the part of commentators to suggest that the election was probably over. Well, the answer is that all of these contextual factors and academic research is based on all other things being equal. And of course, this year, not all other things were equal because we had a unique circumstance this year. And that unique circumstance was the nomination of an African American as the Democratic Party nominee. And so people were reticent to make predictions because of what's become known as the Bradley effect. Now, what is the Bradley effect? There was a former Democratic mayor of Los Angeles, whose name was Tom Bradley, who ran for governor of California. And during the campaign, he had a sizable lead in the polls over his opponent. And right up to election day, his lead remained very sizable. But once the votes were counted, he ended up losing by 2%. Mayor Bradley was African American, and he was running against a white opponent. This led to the speculation that when questioned by pollsters about their vote intent, white Americans will say, yes, they can vote for a black candidate, but when they get in the privacy of the voting booth, are unable to pull the lever. And as a result, in races where you have a black candidate running against a white candidate, you end up seeing that black candidate getting a lower percentage of the popular vote in the election than he was pulling in the polls 24 hours before the election. And the Bradley effect is a measure of the hidden, latent racial voting in the United States. So people looking at this race were concerned about how big the Bradley effect would be. Could it be enough to reverse the outcome? If Senator Obama's leading by 6 to 8 to 10%, could 6 to 8 or 10% of the voters who walk into the voting booth decide not to vote for Senator Obama because of the race? Well, I think it's safe to say that the Bradley effect wasn't as big as most people expected, if it existed at all. Senator Obama won the election, so there wasn't the Bradley effect in terms of the leading candidate losing. But we can ask whether or not his margin in the popular vote was any different than the margin in the polls 24 hours before. And the answer is yes. The popular vote margin is around 6%. As I noted at the top of the presentation. The polls 24 hours before the election suggested that Senator Obama's margin would be anywhere between 8 and 10%. So if there was a Bradley effect, it was a minor Bradley effect of 2 to 3%, which of course didn't alter the election outcome. Now, Senator Obama was quite cognizant of the Bradley effect and adjusted his campaign strategy accordingly. He targeted two groups that he hoped would offset racial voting among white voters. The two groups he targeted were, of course, African Americans and young voters. Now, African Americans and young voters share one common denominator. That common denominator is they have some of the lowest turnout rates of any groups in the United States. So Obama saw great potential here because the polls were showing African Americans overwhelmingly supporting his candidacy. And they were also showing young voters, those between the ages of 18 and 29, overwhelmingly supporting his candidacy. So if he could mobilize and energize those two groups and increase their turnout, he'd be winning a disproportionate share of that additional turnout in the popular vote. And the strategy worked to a T. It may be that he didn't need the strategy because the Bradley effect was either non-existent or smaller than most of us expected. But Senator Obama's impact on the African-American community and on young people in the United States was quite phenomenal. African-American turnout did increase, and 95% of all African-Americans voted for Senator Obama. His popularity among young voters was equally as dramatic. The turnout of 18 to 29-year-olds this year was 54.5%, which is one percentage point shy of the historic record for 18 to 29-year-olds. So Senator Obama did mobilize them, did energize them, and they voted for Senator Obama 66% to Senator McCain's 32%. So every additional percentage point increase in the turnout Senator Obama got from African Americans, he won 95 out of 100 votes. For every additional 100 young voters he brought out, he won an additional 66 votes. In addition, Senator Obama did well with Hispanics. Many people, at least Democrats, were concerned about that because President Bush had done very well with the Hispanic vote in 2004. Obama captured the Hispanic vote by a 2-to-1 margin. Got 12% more of the Hispanic vote than John Kerry got in 2004, which of course meant that John McCain got 12% less of the Hispanic vote than President Bush got in 2004. And the last set of groups that I think Senator Obama owes his election to are the independents and the moderates in the United States, and they really were the swing group. We expected the Democrats to vote overwhelmingly Democratic, which they did. 9 out of 10 Democrats did. We expected the Republicans to vote overwhelmingly Republican, which they did. So the question was, which way would the independents and moderates go? Senator Obama won the independent vote 52 to 44, and won the moderate vote 60 to 39. Now, what accounts for that, especially given the perception of Senator McCain as being a maverick and a moderate himself? One would think that he would have played much better within that constituency. And here I think the answer is Sarah Palin. Senator McCain chose Senator Palin for one primary reason, two secondary reasons. The primary reason was she held the right position to energize the evangelical Christians within the Republican Party, and that she did. The secondary reasons, the first was Governor Palin also had a reputation of being a maverick, and the hope was that perception would help Senator McCain with the independents and moderates. In addition, the hope was that Governor Palin would help Senator McCain with the women's vote. There were many women who became disenchanted with Senator Obama after he defeated Senator Hillary Clinton for the Democratic Party nomination, and Senator McCain hoped to siphon off some of the women's vote by choosing Governor Palin. Secondary reasons didn't work. In fact, it appears they hurt. Governor Palin came across as way too conservative and way too negative, which I think cost Senator McCain with the moderate and independent vote. And I never believed, even when she was chosen, that she would appeal to Clinton women primarily because her views are quite different from Senator Clinton's views. And Senator Obama did win the women's vote 56-43%. So I think on balance, Governor Palin produced a net loss for Senator McCain. It helped a little bit with the more conservative elements within his own party, but I think it cost him dearly among the independents and the moderates. In addition, I believe Senator McCain ran a bad campaign. Whereas Senator Obama had one constant theme, change. Senator McCain couldn't find a theme that seemed to resonate with the American public. And he moved from theme to theme. He started off with the experience theme. And one would think that would work. When you look at these two nominees, Senator McCain probably stands out as one of the most experienced presidential nominees in the history of the United States. 4 years in the House of Representatives, 22 years in the U.S. Senate. Generally, presidential nominees don't have more experience than that. And of course, Senator Obama was one of the least experienced presidential nominees in the history of the United States, serving 8 years in the state legislature and 4 years in the U.S. Senate. So one might have expected the experience argument to work. It didn't. In some ways, I wasn't surprised. And the reason being, because that theme didn't work for Senator Clinton either. The theme this year was change. The conditions were ripe for a theme about change. Senator Clinton tried to use the experience argument. She failed to win the nomination with it. Senator McCain tried to use it in the general election, at least for the first month or so. It didn't work for him either. Then he moved on to the Maverick theme, and that was playing defense. Because Senator Obama was doing a great job of connecting Senator McCain to President Bush, Senator McCain needed a way of distancing himself from that connection. So he began citing his positions on issues where he deviated with either President Bush or the Republican Party. That didn't work for him either. Then, of course, they sent Governor Palin out and attempted to attack Senator Obama's character by trying to tie him with some unsavory figures in the past. That didn't work either. And then, of course, the last theme of the McCain campaign was Senator Obama is way too liberal. He's almost socialist. And that didn't work as well. So it seemed to be a campaign without a theme. Seemed to be a campaign that kept jumping from theme to theme to theme. In addition, his behavior during the campaign, I think, hurt him as well. I think the choice of Governor Palin seemed like a injudicious choice for a candidate who claimed in nearly every speech he gave that I always put America first. It's hard to reconcile that comment with Governor Palin's credentials. Was he putting America first by choosing Governor Palin? In addition, when of course the economic turmoil of the fall began and American financial corporations began to fail, Congress was in the midst of putting together a bailout, and Senator McCain, in an attempt to try to demonstrate some leadership, which in the end ended up backfiring on him, suspended his campaign and argued for a postponement of the debates, and he flew to Washington. And the appearance was of someone who was on the periphery of the debate, who had no business being where he was at, And again, it just sort of reinforced this image of rash, if not erratic, behavior. So I think the combination of the lack of a theme that managed to catch on and some decisions that were made during the campaign ended up hurting him. Saying that, I think Senator McCain was probably the strongest nominee the Republicans could put up. I think anyone else in that Republican field would have lost by a larger margin. And I do think that McCain's campaign isn't the explanation of the election. It's a contributing factor. I think the explanation gets back to the economy, and I believe just about any Democratic nominee could have defeated Senator McCain or any Republican nominee. There was nothing unusual about Senator Obama that Senator Clinton couldn't bring to the table, that Senator Biden couldn't bring to the table, that Senator Dodd couldn't bring to the table. They all would have brought to the table the same label: Democrats equal change. Okay? What's next? Well, of course, the first thing Senator Obama needs to do, or now President-elect Obama needs to do, is assemble his cabinet. This will be interesting. It'll be interesting to see first how many people he pulls from the Clinton administration. He's already pulled one in hiring his chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, from the Clinton administration. I suspect there will be a few others as well. I do think we're going to see some Republicans being asked. I wouldn't be surprised to see Colin Powell asked. I wouldn't be surprised to see Richard Lugar asked, who's a Republican senator from the state of Indiana who has very close ties with Senator Obama. And I wouldn't be surprised to see former Nebraska Republican Senator Chuck Hagel being asked as well. Whether they will accept, of course, is a different story. But I expect there to be at least one or two Republicans in this administration. And of course, the reason for that is it fits very comfortably with Obama's theme of bringing the country together and approaching things in a more bipartisan fashion and a less polarizing fashion. Upon reaching office on January 20th, President-elect Obama can begin right away making some significant changes. Of course, part of it will have to go through Congress, and he will need congressional help for that. I'll talk to that in a minute or two. But one thing he can do almost immediately is reverse some of the executive orders that the Bush administration has put up over the last 4 years, some dealing with the environment. The Bush administration has opened up some public lands for the drilling of oil. It's expected that Senator Obama will close those public lands almost immediately upon assuming the presidency. President Bush has denied public funding to pregnancy counseling groups who counsel pregnant women on abortion. You can expect President-elect Obama to reverse that. So there are a number of decisions that the administration has made over the last 4 years that do not require congressional action, and you could expect President Obama to change many of them during the first week or two of his administration. The big issues, however, Congress will have to deal with. And the question is, how aggressive should President-elect Obama be in presenting his program to Congress, and how responsive will Congress be to that program? The short answer is, well, you have a Democratic Congress, a Democratic president, they should be pretty responsive. Conditions are in crisis mode, so they should be pretty responsive to some dramatic action. On the other hand, the U.S. does face very significant financial constraints. And so the agenda will have to be compromised to some degree. Right now, we're running about $500 billion in yearly budget deficits, which is the highest in U.S. history. Our national debt has gone from $6 trillion when George Bush took office to $10 trillion today. So from 1789 to 2000, we amassed $6 trillion of national debt. In 8 years, we went from $6 to $10 trillion. So the question is going to be, where is the money? And a lot of Obama's program depends on additional funding. And here's where the problem lies with Congress. If you have any familiarity with the Democratic Party, you know that they are not a religion. There isn't just one school of thought among Democrats about most of the issues, but the Democratic Party spans a wide ideological range, from very liberal senators like Ted Kennedy to some very conservative members of the House, that we call Blue Dog Democrats. And the Blue Dog Democrats in the House and the Senate, these conservative Democrats, may not be likely to play ball, because their number one priority is the budget deficit and the national debt. And they, right now, are intent on forcing the liberal Democrats and Senator Obama to find $1 in spending cuts for every additional dollar in additional spending that they propose. That's going to be pretty hard to do with a budget deficit of $500 billion. So it will test President Obama's ability not only to create some bipartisan solutions which involve Republicans voting for the program, but he will be tested by his own party as well, and it will be interesting to see how well he passes the test. The other thing you can count on in an Obama administration, there's the expectation that there could be 2 vacancies on the Supreme Court during the first 4 years. 2 of the justices who everyone expects to retire are moderate to liberal justices on the court. Justice Stevens is 88 years old. Justice Ginsburg is 78 years old. The expectation is they will retire. That would be 2 moderates to liberals lost on the court. Right now, the court generally votes 4 vote the liberal way, 4 vote the conservative way, and there's one guy who sits in the middle. So Senator, talking about the campaign for 2 years, it's hard to get Senator Obama connected to President Obama. President Obama will likely choose, of course, 2 more moderate to liberal judges to the Supreme Court, which will just maintain that equilibrium between the moderates and the conservatives. If there's a conservative retirement or a conservative death, that would indeed swing the court much more in a liberal fashion and in a Democratic Party fashion. Let me stop there and see what kind of questions you have, and the questions don't have to relate to anything I've said. They can be about anything. So with that, let me hear what you have to say.
Just a factual question. You suggested some senators may serve in the administration. Does that mean they have to resign their Senate seat? And how are they filled?
Yes. In the U.S. Constitution, there's separation of powers, which doesn't allow for senators to sit in the executive branch. So, yes, senators would have to resign their seats. So if Senator Lugar was asked by President Obama to be Secretary of State, he would have to resign his seat from Illinois, and then the Illinois governor would appoint the replacement. Yes?
My question is more on elections and politics. You mentioned the length of the lineups. I heard 2, 3, even 4 hour waits in the Australian media. And then you mentioned that the government in power at the state level gets to redesign the boundaries for the various seats. Mm-hmm. Is there a fundamental problem with electoral governance in America? I mean, the longest I've waited is 20 minutes to put a vote in Australia. I mean, is it fair to expect people to wait 4 hours to cast a vote and for politicians to control the seat boundaries?
I find election administration in the United States to be abysmal, to be akin to election administration in third world countries. I thought I knew a lot about American elections until the 2000 presidential election. And they began recounting votes in the state of Florida by lifting the ballots to the light, trying to interpret voter intent. It hasn't gotten much better, as you can see. 3 to 4 hours of standing in line is completely unacceptable. That kind of cost involved in exercising your right as a citizen of a democracy should be unacceptable. And we just haven't figured out a way to do it, and primarily because it's a federal issue. Election administration is left to the states, and then what the states do is they leave it up to the individual counties. So different counties and different states can use different voting mechanisms. Some can use computers, some can use paper ballots. They all have different interpretations of what a bad vote is. It's an embarrassment to see it go on. And when you think of all the money we spend on all the other things we do as a nation.
Excuse me. Thank you very much.
One of the most important things, if not the most important thing, is maintaining the integrity of the democratic process. And somehow we sacrifice that for these other things that we put our money into. Your notion, your comment about the political parties at the state level redrawing district lines is another good point. The lines aren't manipulated. If the Democrats control the governorship and both houses of the state legislature, there are two goals. One is to create as many safe seats for Democratic members of Congress within your state delegation as you can. And then number two, try to create as many vulnerable seats for the Republicans as you can. And they all have the census data, and they're all sitting down and drawing the district lines down neighborhood streets in order to either exclude some Democrats or include some Republicans in order to achieve their desired goal. So it is a deeply political process. As you can see, I didn't defend either.
Yes. An American recently told me that the Electoral College is largely appointed rather than elected. Only two states appoint the delegates, and also that they do not have to follow the popular vote. Is that true?
Each party in each state chooses electors in a different way. It is the party's responsibility in each state, okay? So the the California State Republican Party chooses the 55 people who will be the presidential electors from the state of California. The California State Democratic Party chooses the 55 people who will be the slate of electors from the state of California. Some states allow the presidential nominees of the party to choose the presidential elector. In some states, the slate is chosen by direct primary. In some states, it's chosen by a party, the slate is chosen by a party convention. So the process differs by party within each of the 50 states. It's not uniform. Again, back to this federal principle, which is very, very important in the United States. And in a majority of states, the electors are not legally bound to vote for the candidate that carried the state. Which means, of course, that if Obama carried the popular vote in the state, but the electors aren't legally bound, one or more of those electors could actually cast their electoral vote for John McCain if they wanted to. We call these people faithless electors. People elected under a Democratic slate who then don't vote for the Democratic candidate if the Democratic candidate wins the state. That's less of a problem than you might imagine because the parties are in control of selecting the electors. And of course, you know all about political parties. You have political parties here. And this is quite an honor to be a presidential elector. So parties bestow this honor on party workers who have worked for the party for 40 years, who've contributed vast amounts of money to the political party. It's an honor to be the presidential elector, Republican from the state of California. If John McCain wins, you're not going to vote for Barack Obama. So it's really not a problem, unless of course the election is close. If you have 538 electoral votes, you divide that by two, that's 269, nobody has a majority, then basically any one of the 538 presidential electors could single-handedly alter the election outcome. That's sort of the doomsday scenario. The likelihood of that happening is very slim, but it exists.
A follow-up question would be, there seems to be no room for a third party in that system.
Yeah. Part of this has to do, getting back with kind of rigging the system. There are laws in place which advantage the two major parties and that place obstacles in the way of third parties and minor parties. And the explanation, of course, is Democrats and Republicans are writing these laws. For instance, both major party nominees this year were entitled to $84 million in public spending. They got a check from McCain did take the check from the federal government for $84 million. Obama decided to raise his own money, which was fine. He could reject the check from the federal government and he could raise his own money, which he decided to do. But Ralph Nader didn't get a nickel from the federal government. And the Libertarian Party candidate didn't get a nickel. Well, who wrote these laws? Democrats and Republicans. So, you know, there are ways of fashioning laws that make it advantageous for the two major parties and create obstacles. Ballot access. The two major party nominees' candidates are automatically listed on the ballot. Democrats and Republicans don't have to do anything to get their candidates' names listed on state ballots. Third parties, they have to go out and distribute petitions and have voters sign in order to get a third party name on the ballot. So, lots of rules in the way, and these rules are put in the way by the Democrats and Republicans. Very political process.
I was going to ask, the Electoral College will meet on December 15, I think. Is that correct? What happened at the Electoral College meeting?
The Electoral College meets in mid-December. So the election isn't over yet. They still have to meet in mid-December and cast their ballots. They meet in their state capitals. So California went for Obama. the slate of 55 Democratic electors was elected to the Electoral College. Mid-December, they will travel to Sacramento. The state will have a ballot for them. All 55 will put Barack Obama and Joe Biden down. Then those ballots will be shipped to Washington, D.C., and opened before a joint session of Congress on January 6th. Then only on January 6th do we know who the President of the United States is. That's when it's official. Now, normally at this point, when I get a question like that, somebody says, well, what happens if Senator Obama is assassinated between now and when the Electoral College meets? What happens then? Or if he dies? Or if any president-elect dies before the Electoral College meets, what happens? The answer is both political parties then choose a replacement and then instruct the presidential electors to vote for the replacement. So, if Senator Obama was to die, the Democrats could elevate Biden to be their presidential nominee, bring Hillary Clinton in as the vice presidential nominee, or bring Clinton in as the presidential nominee, keep Biden as the vice presidential nominee, and then instruct all 365 of Obama's presidential electors to vote for the new Democratic ticket. Okay? Yes?
Thanks. Thanks for the presentation, which has been really, really interesting. One of the issues discussed about the electoral process this year was early voting, which was seen to have taken place in, so it's been argued, much larger numbers than previously. And some of the enthusiasm for early voting seemed to be a desire of people to avoid long queues and try and make sure their vote actually, that they were able to actually cast it. I just wonder if you think there is a significant trend in the pattern of early voting, and whether this has some implications for the future, for the pattern of campaigns, if quite a lot of people are wanting to cast their vote before the actual conclusion of the campaign. And just secondly, on the issue of the performance of the electoral system overall, given that these elections seem to have been carried out relatively well compared to 2000 with the Florida problem, or 2004 where there seem to have been some significant problems, perhaps in the conduct of the campaign in Ohio, do you think these relatively successful elections will take some of the drive which seemed to be building up for further electoral reform and change? Or do you think there might be a continuing sort of pressure and motivation for some further significant changes? There was, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, a bipartisan commission headed by former President Carter and former Secretary of State James Baker, which came up with quite a number of recommendations, and I think even canvassed the idea of independent commissions to draw electoral boundaries for the Congress. I don't know whether much attention has been given to this commission of inquiry since. But anyway, those are my two questions.
Okay.
Early voting and then...
Let me start with the last question first. There weren't very many incidents this year. That was a good thing. I just hope that doesn't lull people into a false sense of security, because the problems are still there. The fact is we have 50 different states and tens of thousands of different counties using different mechanisms and different definitions of what constitutes a vote. And I think, if my understanding of the Australian process is correct, I think you have it right and we have it wrong. I think there should be a set of national standards in the United States that apply uniformly across the country. And that would eliminate most of the problems that you saw in 2000 and 2004. So I would hope at least some of this momentum that developed for electoral change as a result of these problems will continue. Part of the fear this year was that the federal government had supplied many of these states with a lot of money to go from paper ballots to computer ballots. The problem with computer ballots is there's no paper trail. And so there's no way to do a recount. And so if a machine fails, the hardware fails, or if the software fails, there's no way of knowing what the vote totals were prior to the failure, or even after the failure occurred. And many people were worried about that. There didn't seem to be very many failures. Although if the election was really, really close, I think we would have heard a lot more bad news about election administration than we did. So I hope the momentum continues, because 2000 was an embarrassment, and I think we haven't moved far enough in the area of electoral reform. The first question with early voting, I think early voting is good and it works, but again, you need the equipment there to be able to accommodate the early voters, and it doesn't really help to have a system of early voting if people are still waiting in line for 4 hours at a time. To me, I couldn't understand at all why they couldn't designate certain spots as early voting slots and just inundate those spots with as many computerized voting machines as possible to sort of minimize the wait for citizens. Obviously, early voting isn't the solution, because you saw these four-hour-long lines. So it goes beyond sort of some of these simpler reforms into, again, the federal principle. These state and localities need more money to be better able to administer their elections a bit more efficiently, and we just don't invest enough into that. Now, with respect to the general question of making it easier for people to vote, which early voting is, what we know is that if you make it easier for people to vote, turnout will go up. Oregon has, all their voting is done by mail. And the turnout in Oregon is about 15 to 20% higher than it is everywhere else. It's simpler to vote. The problem is, again, it's a political issue. It divides Democrats and Republicans. Democrats always want to make it easier to vote, because they know that if more people vote, more Democrats will be voting. Democrats tend to appeal to the working to lower classes. They tend to vote less. So if you make the process easier, they will turn out and vote more. Republicans tend to fight Democratic Party efforts to make voting easy, but they can't really use the political argument, because then it looks self-serving. So they use the fraud argument. The easier you make it to vote, the more likely it is that fraud will occur and jeopardize the electoral process. So there's always fights between Democrats and Republicans about making voting easier, because it has ramifications for turnout, and that has ramifications for the Democrats' percentage of the vote and the Republicans' percentage of the vote. Other questions?
We might make that the last question.
Okay.
It's been an absolutely fascinating lunchtime session. I think everyone has learned a lot more, and we understand the enormous complexity of it to a small degree now. Your economic analysis is fascinating, and we hope perhaps in another couple of years to get you back to do an analysis about how the program post the election has worked.
Well, thank you, Roxanne.
So I'd like you all to thank Sussex Country. And our next lecture is in a fortnight and is on economic future for Australia.
That's very
lovely. Thank you all.
I'm sorry.